Now, it's The Six with the Jeff Calkins Show.
This is Chris Harrington.
Now, it's Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian on the Grizzlies and beyond. Every weekday around 10 a.m. Brought to you by the attorneys of Thomas White and Gill. Find them online at memphisfamilylaw.com.
Chris, what are we listening to?
That is Slippin' and a Slidin' by Richard Penniman, a.k.a. Little Richard. One of the first generation rock and roll artists who died this weekend.
What was his deal? What was his story?
His story is that he was the wildest, the most chaotic, the most anarchic in all kinds of ways of the original rock and roll artists that sprang up in the 50s. He was sort of, in some ways, sort of a companion to Jerry Lee Lewis, and it's crazy that they were the last two left, as sort of piano-pounding guys, you know, natural, you know, musical geniuses who led sort of chaotic lives outside of their music, sort of boundary-pushing chaotic lives outside of their music. To me, Little Richard was... He and Chuck Berry, more than anyone else, sort of they were sort of smugglers. They smuggled content onto the charts that people didn't realize they were absorbing. With Chuck Berry, a lot of times that was racial or sort of social commentary. With Little Richard, it was about stuff around gender and sexual orientation and sexuality and race. And like a lot of the Little Richard hits that people think of as like sock hoppy 50s rock and roll, like, you know, is. Are really about subjects we can't talk about on a family radio show.
Really? Give me, like, for an example.
Yeah, I don't want to get too specific on some of this. Like, it's, let's just say Good Golly Miss Molly and Lucille and Long Tall Sally are about some pretty prurient stuff.
Really? I'll have to Google that.
But, yeah. Like, Slippin' and Slidin' is probably my favorite Little Richard song, and I used it, to me, it's sort of a statement of principle. Slippin' and Slidin', peepin' and hidin' won't be your fool no more. This idea of sort of smuggling stuff or working on sort of two levels. I did a college thesis was on popular music in the civil rights movement, and so the section I did on 50s music, I actually titled "Slippin' and a Slidin'."
Oh, really? Okay, good. Yep. Well, that's totally cool. I'll have to Google this. My education continues. Did you ever see him? John Bifus had a tweet that he saw a wonderful couple set of tweets that he saw. He sort of saw him. Walking in one day, and the wonderful line was his whatever he was wearing looked too heavy for his bones, and weary. And then he gets up and he's at the piano, and all of a sudden it is electric, and sort of just owns and occupies the space. Did you ever see him?
No, I mean, I think John is referencing seeing him at, I think he played at a Bill Street Music Fest one year, like in, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years. But no, I never saw him play. And it's sort of odd that, I mean, he would do these performances occasionally, but even more, a lot of the 50s rock and roll artists didn't really transition to the 60s well unless they went into country.
Right.
Like Jerry Lee Lewis did, and like Johnny Cash sort of always was. A lot of them, like, once the Beatles came, were sort of rendered obsolete in a way, or rendered oldies acts that sort of struggled to keep up. And so, like, after that burst of music in the 50s, he never really made recorded music, for the most part, that really mattered again. Although there is some stuff in the 60s that's straight soul that's pretty great. But, like, he just never transitioned. Him, more than anyone else, just didn't really transition into being, relevant. Like, a viable artist, you know, on his own terms after that.
Interesting. Okay. So, what did you observe this weekend? There's been this sort of, I've heard a lot of anecdotal, boy, it was chaos. People are mistaking the reopening of restaurants to being a sign that all bets are off and it's going. And so I took calls on this, and basically most people said that they saw people wearing their masks, and they saw people, they went to restaurants maybe and sat down, and half of the tables were closed off. There were some that were concerned. I don't know. Were you out and about this weekend? What do you think?
No, I mostly observed my deck and my new fire pit and the rest of my family on a family bike ride.
Uh-huh.
And I observed a friend of mine who's sick, who I went to visit. And I didn't really – I mean, I guess I went to Home Depot and I may have gone. I think I went to a grocery. Yeah, I went to a grocery. I went to a Kroger and I went to a Home Depot. And what I observed there was not dissimilar to what I had observed in big box stores earlier in the week that I had written about, which was, you know, I felt, actually I went to Target too. I guess I did get out. I sensed roughly about 50-50 mask use in those places. These are all Midtown East Memphis places.
Right.
I saw Gary had a tweet about, you know, he went to the grocery store in Horn Lake and no one, or Hernando or whatever, no one was wearing a mask. And I also saw some of the responses he got, and it seemed very, like, it depends on where you were and when you were there. Like, right. People range from, oh, I see people wearing masks all the time. Do I see no one wearing a mask? And, you know, how you take all of that anecdotal and boil it into what is reality, I don't know. And I tried to do something slightly more than anecdotal when I sort of counted 300 people at three different places, and it was slightly more than 50% masks when I went a week ago. So I don't know. I think it's hard to get from the anecdotal to the what is widespread reality.
Well, it's funny. While I was taking calls this morning earlier on the show, John Martin texted me. He said he went to a Kroger in Germantown Saturday, and more than 80% were wearing masks. And then he also texted, Gary lives in MAGA, Mississippi. That's where no one's wearing masks. Like, I mean, I do think there are people in Mississippi who wear masks, certainly. But I don't think it's an accident.
I think if you did, Germantown. Like, if you sent someone... Yeah. If you send someone to Kroger in Germantown or whatever, send someone to Kroger Hernando, have them just stand there and, like, do hash marks right. all day, and, like, I think you'd probably get different numbers, right?
I think that's right. And then we had a caller from South Memphis who said, I love my people, and his people are African-Americans. He said he was worried by what he was seeing there. I do think different sections of the town are treating this differently. To the NBA, just for a moment... there was Friday, very clear that the NBA players want nothing to do with living in a bubble. And I don't blame them, I'll be honest. Like, for 2 months, they don't want the bubble thing. But then we did also over the weekend have a UFC bout or slate, which went on despite the fact that earlier in the week some fighters had tested positive. And the theory is that's the way through. That you just say, okay, fine, you tested positive, you go sit here, we'll continue. And there's no reason that you can't do that and have the Grizzlies play in an empty FedEx Forum. They don't have to be in a bubble. They're going to be on private planes flying all over the country, back and forth to L.A. for their five-game series or whatever it is against the Lakers. I don't know. Any thoughts on it? It doesn't feel like the bubble thing. Baseball is also pushed back against the bubble.
My thought is what you're describing. Like, yeah. You know, if you have that level of testing and quick turnaround and results, you know, is probably what should happen. That's also what should happen everywhere.
Exactly.
That's what should happen. Like with everyone who works at Kroger and everyone who works at FedEx and everyone who works at the zoo where I just came from and everyone everywhere. You know, That was the whole point of, like, let's quote-unquote shut down and let's ramp up our ability to handle all this. And we didn't really ramp it up. Like, it's sort of been piecemeal, like the different grocery stores have been piecemeal.
Right.
Like you know, I think the medical system in Memphis has done a pretty good job, but it also hasn't had to deal with the brunt of something like, you know, they had in New York. But the idea of, like, let's test everyone every day at, like, before they come to work, like, that shouldn't just be for the NBA. That should be, like, for everybody.
Now, in fairness, I don't know that the UFC tested everybody or if they just tested the symptomatic. Do we know, Jeffrey? I don't think we know. Did they test everybody?
I thought I read last week they tested everyone, but I'll double check.
Yeah, I think they probably did. You're not obviously not going to be able to do that with everybody, but for the reasons you discuss. Anyway, any further sense, it felt more pessimistic, if that's the way you want to phrase it, more like we might not have NBA over the weekend than after this sort of discussions. Than earlier. Any thoughts on whether we're going to have further thoughts on the NBA?
I think they're going to exhaust every possibility to find a way to declare an NBA champion for this season. And if that goes into July or August, you know, I guess if you're just moving a dial like one way or the other, I guess the dial moves in a more pessimistic direction. But I still think they'll try to find a way to put a cap on the season. Like I've never believed that they're going to get all 30 teams involved. Or I mean, I think that you have to make it as narrow as possible. But I mean, I would bet slightly towards they'll find a way to put a cap on the season.
Did you watch Last Dance this time around or no?
I did. Yes.
Thoughts?
So I didn't really think about it until I saw people tweeting about it, and then I got mad about it. Too great to get mad at all, but like the fact that they just didn't acknowledge like Hakeem Olajuwon and the Rockets at all. Like, I know it's like not a documentary about that, but the idea of like what happened in Jordan's absence in the NBA beyond just who the Bulls lost to, I don't know. I thought that was kind of odd.
Well, they also don't acknowledge that he was married through all of this.
His
wife doesn't appear in any of this.
Right. I guess you can't be annoyed for Hakeem Olajuwon
if you're not from Juanita. Right.
It was a reminder, like, again, of how wild the baseball thing was.
Totally wild.
The biggest athlete in the world just went to play minor league in some other sport.
Totally wild. At age 30.
Yeah.
He was 30 years old at the top of his game, and he just walked away.
Now, and it's not like he played, like, college baseball or something, and it was like, you know, he wasn't like Danny Ainge.
Yeah, this isn't Russell Wilson.
And then
he
goes the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, and I agree that I saw some baseball player like tweet this, a pitcher who sort of said, you know, I wasn't able to hit 200 in Double A, and that was always my belief. Like this idea that he embarrassed himself, like I think it's amazing that he hit 200 in Double A.
Right. And as I think it was Jerry Reinsdorf who said it, when someone comes out of college ball, even, or certainly high, like someone who's been playing baseball every day, never stopped playing baseball, they put him in rookie ball or they put him in the floor.
Well, that's something I didn't know. I didn't know that they sent him to Double-A because that was the lowest level where they could accommodate media.
Yeah.
I just thought they sent him to Double-A because like you couldn't deem to put Michael Jordan in rookie ball, but apparently that wasn't the case.
Yeah. So, but either way, like Double-A baseball is good baseball, and he knocked in 50 runs and hit 200. So, yes, I it was fairly extraordinary. I do wonder what would have happened if there hadn't been the baseball strike that year. But one of the things I saw last night was a little pushback that this one was the first – it started to feel more like a Jordan PR piece. And I don't know, like I'll be honest, like the stuff around going to baseball and the death of his father, and that all seemed totally reasonable to me. I admired him. Now maybe they wanted me to. The fact that he had done what he had done, won three straight, people are insinuating that the death of his father had to do with his gambling when there's no evidence of that. At the press conference, as he's walking away, he looked happy. Like, he looked really happy when he was walking away.
Right.
It didn't feel like PR BS. Go ahead.
Well, you had the guy, I guess, who one of his biographers, who I'd never heard of, who said, like, you know, he told me a year earlier this was his plan, that this is what he wanted to do, but he couldn't do it yet because he felt obligated for the Olympics and he wanted to win the three in a row. And I think it was the same guy who sort of shot down the whole, like, NBA spitted him conspiracy, I think, in the most effective way, which is the same response I have when people do the lottery was
lottery
rigged, the Patrick Ewing lottery was rigged, or lotteries are rigged conspiracy of just follow the money. Like, you can't – you know, in terms of the Jordan thing, the idea that David Stern was going to sit the most popular player on the most popular franchise for a year and a half was sort of crazy. And when people talk about, like, rigging the lottery, like, you expose yourself to a lawsuit that will bring down the entire league? Sure.
Yeah, insanity. Exactly right. I guess the part that might be overdone is the George Karl walks through a restaurant, doesn't...
Yeah, because someone says, well, George Karl shouldn't have done that. But what you realize is it doesn't matter what anyone does.
Right.
He will invent whatever slight he needs to invent, like LeBradford Smith or whatever.
Right.
Like the idea that anyone did anything that like brought Jordan's anger down upon them, Jordan was going to bring the anger down upon them for whatever reason he could find. It really didn't matter. Like people should have gone harder, really.
Do you believe fundamentally in the I was a jackass to my teammates because I had to be, and look at what we accomplished as a justification for being a jackass?
How'd Tim Duncan do?
Right. It's not the only way you can do this.
You know,
How does Steph Curry do? You know, like
right.
He does. It is the way he did it, and that's fine. Yeah. But it is not the only way to do it.
But it is that to the degree that that stuff that becomes has become a topic in the documentary, it is positioned in a way that sort of defends it. You're right that it is the Jordan perspective on, like, this is what we needed to do to win, and I wanted these guys to be winners. And, like, that's fine. I mean, you know, I think different people respond to things in different ways. If you look at Steve Kerr, who, like, got in the fight with Jordan, like, look at how he coaches. It doesn't seem to be like that, right? But I think, like, good coaches sort of realize different people operate in different ways, and different people respond to different kinds of motivations. And maybe that's another reason why Michael Jordan was a great player, but, like, not a great executive, or you know, maybe wouldn't be a great coach in the way that some former players have been.
Yeah, I guess I'm not. I don't object to it as an explanation for Michael Jordan and as the way he led and everything else, and it worked and all of that. The only place I object is the idea that you have to do it. And you point out Tim Duncan. How many titles did Tim Duncan win?
I think five.
Yeah. So and he wasn't a jerk to anybody. Now, mind you, the coach was a jerk to the media, but beyond that, yeah, whatever. It's just like that, though. You don't have to be a jerk to the media. Like Steve Kerr isn't a jerk to the media. Like, there's lots of different ways to win. Pete Carroll in the NFL wins differently than Bill Belichick in the NFL. Yes, there's lots of different ways to do it. All right, I know you're going to be writing about the zoo later. The zoo is opening up. It's sort of the next. We've had these restaurants, small businesses, etc. Now we have sort of attractions in Memphis opening up, without sort of talking about all of it, because I know you're going to be writing a column about it later. What do you think about the zoo opening up?
Everyone sort of is developing their own sense of, like, what's safe and what's not, and what you're comfortable with and what's not. I am generally, like, I'm less concerned about being outside, as long as if I'm keeping, like, you know, social distance practices, than I am being inside around people.
Right.
So I think I'd be more willing to take my son and walk through the zoo than take my son to a restaurant. Assuming that, you know, the capacity and the flow works, which is what you won't be able to know until you get people in the zoo. They can hold something like 10 to 12,000 people at a time at full capacity, and they're limited to 2,500.
Right.
And I think the thing that I think people, and I haven't talked to people, I'm just guessing, that people don't quite realize, I think people get, like, the social distance and the mask, but they are setting it up so it's a guided thing through the zoo. It's like a one-way aisle, and it's not you walk in and you just go wherever you want to go, which is the way the zoo normally works.
Right.
And that's what, when I was talking to Jim Dean, the CEO, about, you know, what he expects pushback on, to me, my guess is there'll be more confusion about that than about 6 feet and masks. It'll be about, well, wait a minute, I just want to go see
the elephants, right? Yeah, exactly. And you can't just go see the elephants. It's like walking through IKEA. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. No, that's a good point. That's a good point. Except even more policed. IKEA has a little shortcut. You know, between rooms. But this is a guided path through the zoo.
I got it. All right, we'll hear more about it later. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
The Jason and John Show.
Brian Windhorst covers the NBA for ESPN, and he joins us now. All right, Brian, are we closer today to a return than we were 2 months ago? Is it hard to say? What's the status of the NBA today?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's been progress made. I still don't think there's any firm timeline, though. I know that's so frustrating for so many people. And the fact that they're getting back into facilities is obviously a positive step, but it doesn't mean that in 2 weeks will be practices. You know, the biggest thing about this, and it's really for all of us, is that there's no way to have any predictive nature here. As soon as you think you may have some sort of footing, everything changes. And so, you know, just as an example, the NBA has had to change its standard for when they get back to playing. And what I mean by that is they had been saying that they want there to be enough tests for the average American that their testing would not influence it. In other words, they didn't want to say, we're going to come back and play, and the Memphis Grizzlies are going to need 1,500 tests over the next month to do so. And they didn't want to take that away from the citizens of Memphis. And that was their plan. The problem, guys, is our level of testing dropped we were testing a certain level, and then over the course of 10 days, we were testing 100,000 less. Now it's back up, but then the NBA had to shift and say, okay, it's not the average citizens, it's the first responders. Once the first responders have enough tests, because they're looking for a footing for public relations. And that may change three or four more other times. And that aspect of it is just one little tiny sliver, but it illustrates how the NBA just not only about keeping their players healthy, but even managing the message has been such a moving target that it's hard to move forward.
Brian, from the players you talk to and certainly the representatives of them, where are they at in terms of the safety? That big question, right, that if you start and someone comes down with it, and obviously you pose a LeBron or somebody like that, where are players now? Are they generally feel, okay, let's get back? No, half of them, no, too concerned still about safety. Where are the players now in terms of the concern about if someone gets it after you've started?
It's all over the board.
Okay.
There are guys who believe that if you take proper precautions, they can be ready to go. They want to get back and play. And there's other guys who say, there's no reason for me to even think about playing in a game until they have a vaccine. There's guys who say, hey, I want to go back to Europe because I want to get to my family there, and we're weeks and weeks away from doing this. Why can't I just go home? There's other guys who've been saying, I just need to get back in the practice facility. I can't get outside my apartment. I don't have any place to shoot. I don't have a good place to work out. It's all over the board, and that's the big thing. I mean, one of the biggest challenges that sports leagues are going to have, not just the NBA, but sports leagues in general, are different parts of the country are going to have different effects of this virus and different local laws and local expectations. I mean, the NBA is in 28 different markets. Those 28 markets are not all going to be on the same page for a long time, I don't think. And this will be a huge issue for football. I mean, I really do believe that there will be parts of this country where there will be football fans. I'm not saying they're going to be 60,000 of them, but there will be football fans in football stadiums by the fall. And there are going to be other parts of the country who say there's not going to even be a football practice in 2020. And how you manage that is a huge issue. And I think the NBA is only the beginning of confronting that reality.
Is there anything to learn from UFC 249 this weekend? As we know, they had a fighter tested positive. Two of his corner men tested positive. The event went on, and I guess we'll find out, right, in a week or two if it really was limited to just that fighter and his corner men. But the event went on. I watched it. As a fan, it was great. Is there anything to learn, you know, for the NBA, for the NFL, from what happened over the weekend in UFC 249, in the fact that they moved forward, Brian? They went on and they had the event in it. I'm imagining the PPV buys were through the roof.
I think it's a good lesson for all sports, is that you don't just need a plan to get your people back. You need a plan for when you have a positive test, when you have a positive test. And that plan isn't just when the test comes back and says positive. It's how you do business leading up to the positive test. So let me give you an example of this. When I have talked to experts who have talked about how the NBA would have to frame a return to play, they've said that you really want to keep teams in, you know, clusters. Mm-hmm. They can all be in the same place, but even within that place, within clusters, I don't know. Nobody knows the answer, whether it's 14, 16, whatever. And the reason you do that is so that you limit the exposure if there's a positive test. So, you know, let's say the NBA came back, and let's say it was all 30 teams, and you had six groups of five. If one group of five had a positive test in it, you could just quarantine those teams and let the other things go on. And that's what I mean by preparing for a positive test. The UFC, I'm not 100% clear with everything that they did because I don't follow that sport, but they had some sort of plan in place that enabled them to keep going. Now, as a basketball fan, you would say, now, wait a minute. This plan for a positive test, like, what happens if that happens during the playoffs? You know, what do you do? Mm-hmm. You know, Do you quarantine the whole team? Do you eliminate the teams? I mean, what do you do? Do you quarantine them for a day? And that's why I mean you have to have an operational plan leading up to it, not just after you get the positive test. The other thing that is really, really important, and this has been an issue in China and is held one of the reasons why their league has been held back, is the false negative. Guys, the false negative is one of the scariest things in this whole thing. That's why it doesn't just have to be tests that you have to have. It has to be quality tests. If you have a false negative, it can cause all kinds of havoc. And, you know, for example, we just saw that, you know, in the vice president's office. They described how the woman who tested positive was negative the day before and positive the day she took the test. Was that a false negative the day before? Or was she truly negative? Because I'm going to tell you something, if it was a false negative, we're going to have a real problem. You know what I'm saying? And that is just, it's just a whole web of things that get on top of each other and why this is so hard to get your hands around, and why there's so many people who are so conservative in bringing this thing back because of all of these, you know, these challenges.
How closely is the NBA still watching what's going on with China? Just saw Yao Ming, and he's going through the options. There was one point, Brian, following your reporting, I thought China, and it was all a hope for all of us, would be back, but you made the point they've been stalled out. How closely is the NBA still watching what happens there? Because essentially, right, it's the same. You've got to pull teams together. You've got to play it in one area. Isn't it essentially sort of the plan that the NBA is looking at?
Yeah. I mean, the NBA is watching everything, guys. The NBA is watching everything, and that's the thing. Like, it's just so hard to get everything into alignment. And I think what China can teach us, even though they haven't been able to restart basketball. Now, they did restart baseball, but for my world, I only really care about the basketball aspect of it, is because there's so many difficult things you have to square off, get under control to do it. And, they have been trying since February. They had their first thoughts of coming back in February, and then they thought for sure it was April 1st, and they thought it for sure it was April 15th. Now they're trying to figure out how to sometime do it in June, okay? The NBA, as you mentioned, has been on ice for 2 months. The CBA in China has been on ice for 4+, and they still can't figure it out. So that is what the cautionary tale is how difficult it's going to be.
We are, of course, talking to Brian Windhorst, covers the NBA for ESPN. Just sort of based on, you know, what you know, Brian, I mean, do you think it's, you know, I think the idea is that the NBA will return. Is it July, August? I mean, is that what we are sort of talking about now? I mean, is there any hope for June based on any conversations that you have with teams across the league? What sort of is the unofficial expectation for, you know, when games may resume?
Well, a month ago, they were hoping that they would have clarity by May 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? May 1st came and went, no clarity.
Yep.
All right? Now they're hoping for sometime in June.
Yep.
Boy, do I hope we have it. But we don't know. We may have clarity in June. We may get to mid-June, and they may say, hey, we got to wait till mid-July. You know? Guys, I just don't know. Nobody knows the answer to this. What I will say is I do think that there is a strong desire to crown a champion. And you can call it an asterisk or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in asterisks when it comes to championships, because regardless of what Shaq says, overcoming this delay and then coming back and then potentially winning, you know, in some sort of quarantine possibly, is a huge thing to overcome as a team. And if you're able to overcome that and win 4 playoff rounds, whether they're 3-game series or they're, you know, they're best of 15, whatever they're going to be, it's everybody had to overcome this challenge. So I do think that's going to happen. When? I don't know. If Adam Silver asked my opinion, if he called me up and said, hey, I know you've done a lot of work on this, what would you advise me to do? My advice would be tell everybody that we're not going to play for a while. Let everybody go into an off season. Have your draft sometime as normal in the summer. And then in the fall, come back, have training camps, and just play the playoffs. Have the draft picks be able to take part in practices or some G League option or whatever.
Interesting.
Play your playoffs and then immediately proceed to your next season. Do your free agency in 10 days. which sounds ridiculous, but actually is not that ridiculous considering there's not going to be much free agency this year. And we did it in 10 days of coming out of lockout 2011. Let the teams who are not going to be in the playoffs, who are not in the top eight in each conference, let them ease back into it. Let them make sure everything, and then come back and have your following season. Then let the other teams, let baseball and football and hockey and golf and NASCAR and all these people who are beating the door down, let them be the first through the door, and let them make the mistakes. And you can come back, you can crown your champion, you can move on to your next season. I think just allowing time is the way to go, in my opinion. But that's just me. What do I know?
You know, Michelle Roberts came out very strongly against, quote-unquote, the bubble. You know, she said that sounds like incarceration to her. But, I mean, in terms of this NBA season resuming, I mean, isn't there an understanding across the league that it would have to be, you know, I mean, in a centralized location? Like, maybe you could do Vegas for the Western Conference and you could do Walt Disney World for the Eastern. But isn't there, I mean, an understanding that, you know, we're trying to limit, you know, travel exposure because we don't want to, you know, run up the risk of contracting the virus? I mean, is that not the understanding across the league, Brian?
Well, I think there's people are sort of making a bit of a mistake here. I think she was speaking to one thing, but it was sort of applied to another. I think what she said is she doesn't want it where to me, there's a difference between a bubble and a centralized location. A bubble to me means all you guys are in this hotel complex and you can't leave, and nobody's coming in and nobody's coming out. We'll have trucks to bring in food, and you're not leaving, and your families are at home or they're down the road or whatever, and you don't see them. That's what I think of as a bubble, and that's what she's referring to. That she doesn't like that. And by the way, neither does Adam Silver. He's pretty much said that's not going to happen. But the concept of everybody getting together in the same place, or maybe your families could come, and maybe you wouldn't be confined to that location, that you could have some freedom when you weren't playing basketball, that I think is what they're talking about. Those are two different things. Now, if you're going to do option B there, you better have testing, you better have plans, you better have all kinds of measures in place. It's a lot more complicated to protect more people than it is to protect the bubble, which is why in the laboratory the bubble makes more sense. But you know, I like what she is saying there, regardless of how you felt about what she said, that's not even really under consideration by the league.
Last Dance, what have you thought, Brian? Have you enjoyed it as much as LeBron seems to? He's been live tweeting it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he grew up, like so many of us, a Jordan fan. Even though I was in college during those days, I don't remember so much of it. So to me, it's the small details that I love. For example, one of the things last night that just made it would just jaw drop was that when Jordan came back, the mid-season in 95, when he came back, his first game, he put his shorts on backwards. I did not remember that. If that was well known, I did not remember it, you know. Dennis Rodman's midseason vacation to Vegas. I mean, if that was well known, I did not remember it. I've seen people say, well, if you read all these books, you would know all this stuff. And I go, well, I didn't read the books. I'm sorry. I didn't, I was in high school. I wasn't reading the books. So, the big overarching points are obviously interesting, but it's the small stuff that I'm enjoying the most. And, I'll tell you one thing. People are breaking it down like it's a game. And it's just because we have nothing else to break down.
Exactly.
I'm just enjoying it. And I hope – let me tell you what I hope. I hope more athletes are willing to be more open than so many of their projects are. I know that there's been this criticism that Jordan isn't opening everything wide and being 1,000,000% open. I get it. Go do a documentary on any single one of our lives. If we have the control, we're not telling everything, okay? But there's a lot in here being told. And a lot of these guys who have their own production companies who are producing their own documentaries, there's a dozen or so players who do this. I mean, I enjoy them, but they're not open. And as a result, they just sort of come out. Some of their fans watch them and they go away and nobody cares. If you want to really do a documentary that people are going to, number one, pay for, and number two, remember and enjoy, you're going to have to allow certain things. And guess what? Jordan didn't allow it for 20 years. Okay?
Right.
It wasn't like he was ready to do this in 1999. So, but I'm just saying, I hope that it leads to athletes being more willing to capture what's really going on and really in their minds what's really going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely. Hey, Brian, man, we appreciate the time as always. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, man, that's that scene at the end of
seven.
Was it seven?
Where he's breaking down why he played this way.
Yeah, no. When he was on the floor, when he was on the floor after he won the title on Father's Day.
Okay, so yeah.
I mean, hearing him sob as I don't remember. I know there are pictures of that, but I don't remember it. And so that was like, that stopped me in my tracks, man. Like the just the raw emotion. Like Jordan didn't show emotion like that. You know what I mean? Like that was a that was a side of him that he did not show.
Yeah, it was winning that first one without his dad around. And it can I imagine you probably take that for granted during the season. You think about it, what it's going to be like without dad, you know, because he obviously was on a championship track again once he came back as the real 2-3 that next year.
Yep.
And and then you had the other element of what does it mean? I mean, you had everybody asking him, what does it mean on Father's Day?
Yep.
You know, he's thinking about it beforehand.
Yep.
So, it's the little boy in all of us that we've talked about this before that wants to make dad proud.
Yep.
And so you're thinking about how he's up there watching you, and yeah, he was overcome with the emotion. So that scene there, that was, and then you saw him. What I thought you were referring to at first, in terms of the emotion he was overcome with, just talking about the way he pushed guys.
Yep.
And maybe I'm not so liked, but if you weren't down with it, then
why do you think he got as emotional as he did when he was talking about that?
Does it come down to maybe some part of him wanting to be liked, but he sacrificed that part?
Yeah.
You know, to push guys.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we say is the way he can drag you to greatness, and that's what you're watching these guys, and he really did it by fear.
He did.
Right? I mean, it was really by fear. And let me go ahead and take Steve Kerr, who's playing around too much for me, and show, you know, and Phil Jackson's giving Steve Kerr the calls, and all of a sudden you want to, you know, Steve pushed him in the chest, and that's the thing that opens up you, so he turns, but he took out the like me. I'm not worried about, you know, about you liking me. I'm going to be an ass to get you to, you know, as he put it, I'm going to get in your, you know what, to get the best out of you. And like we said, I don't know that his teammates loved him. Like when you hear B.J. Armstrong ask this question to some of these, but they all respected him because of the level that he would, you know, he didn't ask anything of you that he wouldn't do. He was the first in sprints.
Yep.
So how could you sit there whining when he's leading you in sprints?
That's right.
Don't miss the Jason and John Show tomorrow at 11 a.m. on 92.9 FM ESPN.